Winston Zulu, HIV and TB activist from Zambia. Thank you so much for joining us. One of the key themes of this conference is the healthcare systems in developing countries. You've experienced the healthcare systems firsthand. Can you just talk about that from your perspective? What a patient goes through when they're seeking treatment for tuberculosis in a developing country?
Well, I think the first thing that you are likely to find is a healthcare worker who is frustrated, demoralized, because their housing allowance wasn't paid last month. The previous month, and maybe their salary, they have arrears that are not paid. They haven't gone for retraining for many years. And I mean, so when you go there, you really find someone who is just there, but in spirit, they are thinking of maybe migrating to the UK or to other countries where they can get a better deal. And once you find a healthcare worker who's like that, then you get the kind of service that is not adequate, a service that is not really good.
So what do you think are some ways to actually improve the systems, improve the service in these developing countries?
Well, one of the, you know, most countries in Africa still depend a lot on donor funding. And these funds come with conditions. One of the conditions is the government shouldn't spend more than a certain ceiling, a certain limit. But the donor community do not specify in which areas the government should cut, you know. So as you know, the government won't cut on defense. The governments won't cut on things like their own allowances. So they will cut on the softest parts, like, for example, education. They will cut on health. And so this is what has happened. I think the solution is it's well and good, for example, for the International Monetary Fund to say government should not overspend, they should work within the budget. But then to tell them that if they have to make any cuts to achieve those goals, they shouldn't cut health and education. Because I think it's just a contradiction to say we'll give you this money for development, but don't spend it on health and education. It just won't work, you know. Now, of course, you know that if the government knows that if it cuts on the military, for example, on defense, they'll probably be sent packing the following week. You know what I mean? There'll be a military coup or something like that. So there has to be some kind of a way of the international community funding directly, like education and health. And I think the British have started doing that in Malawi, where they're training and making sure that the healthcare workers in Malawi don't come to London.
And what about the Global Fund to fight HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria? They also fund directly, correct? Specific projects in countries. So how has that worked?
That's the best way to go. And I think that also dispels the whole myth that the countries in Africa hold people are corrupt. I think corruption starts right in Washington and London and Paris. You know, when the leaders, our leaders, are signing the contracts. Because the Global Fund, for instance, have suspended some of their funds to countries where they were not used well. And because they are dealing direct with civil society, they're not only dealing with government, but they're dealing with different players. They are able to monitor who is using the money well and who is not using the money well. When they say governments in Africa are corrupt, I think the people who give that money already know that the money won't be used for the intended purposes. They have an idea and they just allow it to happen. That's my view.
Now, when you come to conferences like this, you have access to leaders, scientific leaders, political leaders. You also said you recently spoke to the House of Commons. Mm. What do you say to these leaders and what message from the tuberculosis community do you want them to hear?
Well, first of all, I think tuberculosis is one of the diseases that is neglected, is a disease of the poor. Very few people of influence now or power get to die of TB. So it's very poor people in their hearts dying, you know, very slowly. There's nothing dramatic. It's not something like all seven people have been bombed in some place. You know what I mean? That carries a lot of news. But with TB, people die very quietly and so on. So when I meet world leaders, I say, well, look, you may be alarmed when you hear that 3,000 people have died somewhere or 5,000 people. But TB in a year, about 2 million people die, you know. So, and also that the more you allow a situation like TB to go unchecked, the more it becomes a real global danger, you know, because TB is transmitted by air, you know, if you breathe and so on. So you can't control it in one part of the world if you don't control it in another part of the world. So in the last 3 years, I think we've seen some progress. The G8 meetings, for example, they never used to be TB as an agenda on its own. You know, it always was something like TB, I mean, it would be AIDS and other infectious diseases. You know, it wasn't actually mentioned. But when you really think, how, if you come to Africa, people dying of AIDS, what are they dying of? And you find that the majority are dying of tuberculosis, and it can be cured. So that's the message that I always take.
So are you hopeful now that the G8 is beginning to address tuberculosis specifically? And how do you think that G8 nations can be held accountable for the promises that they've made for tuberculosis?
Well, I think the trouble really with this area of advocacy, if you like, is that people can make promises. Big governments have made promises and haven't actually implemented them. And like I was saying in my short speech yesterday, that if one government goes deliberately and kills their own people, then they can be brought to the International Court of Justice for crimes against humanity and stuff like that. And yet many governments append their signatures to declarations and commitments and so on, saying they're going to do this to stop unnecessary deaths of people dying of diseases like malaria and tuberculosis. And yet when they go back home, they do nothing, you know. And I think there should have been a mechanism somewhere where you say, okay, if you agreed that you're going to do this and you still allow your people to die, we're going to impose some kind of sanctions like they did, for example, in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe can't come to England and they've frozen some of their assets. And you know, there has to be some way of making these things legally binding, you know. Otherwise, our leaders say we're going to do this, we're looking into it, and they're not doing it. You know, there has to be some kind of a monitoring situation, not really just peer monitoring between themselves, because most of them are bad anyway. So we need some kind of an independent group outside that can say, look, if you agree to do this, and that government should put in this much amount, it shouldn't just be money coming from outside. That's the other myth, that our governments are so poor that they can't put in money. The money has to come from outside. I think we do need aid from outside for development, you know what I mean? So that we become development. We don't need aid to be used, you know, like to almost like handouts. We don't need that. I think the money that we need is for development. But we also pay tax, and we know that when leaders are determined to cut out a certain problem for themselves or whatever they've chosen to do, they do it. So there's no excuse, to be honest, for any of the African countries for not doing something about a disease like TB.
Of the $56 billion that the global plan to stop TB was calling for in the next 10 years, they said that two-thirds of that was actually going to be coming from the actual nations that are endemic with TB. Yeah. Do you think that that's realistic, for two-thirds of that $56 billion over 10 years is actually going to come from the endemic countries?
Well, I think it may not be realistic, but I think it's worth aspiring to. Because, you know, the thing is, the total budget on defense of African countries probably is more than that. You know what I mean? And we don't have any real enemies. Most of the countries in Africa have no, well, there's always internal strife, you know what I mean? But we don't have outside enemies. And so often those defense budgets are basically defending the ruling clique, you know? And I don't agree with that. And I think if we were to shift some of the funds that go into defense to try and fund the global plan against TB, I think it's money worthwhile spent, because TB is the real enemy. You know, for example, take a country like Zambia. Angola is a friendly country. Congo is a friendly country. Tanzania is friendly. Malawi is friendly. Mozambique is friendly. Zimbabwe is friendly. Botswana is friendly. You know, Namibia is friendly. We have eight countries surrounding us, all of them that are friendly. Now, maybe it can be argued and said, well, maybe one of the countries is going to become unfriendly in future. But still, that's no reason why you should be neglecting a current enemy that is killing so many people. I think hundreds of people die in Zambia every day from tuberculosis and HIV. And yet, we spend so little.
That leads me to another question, which is the link between HIV and tuberculosis, and actually investing in those two systems in terms of treating those two diseases and bringing those together and actually putting the resources towards that. Yeah. How do you actually strengthen the HIV communities and the tuberculosis communities working together?
Well, the two communities have their strengths. For example, the AIDS community are very good in advocacy. You know, they've worked around advocacy for many years, and there is patient involvement. And also because it's a long chronic illness, and you always have people living with HIV. While with TB, people get well, you know, or either they die or they get well and get over with it and continue living their lives. On the other side, on the TB side, they've always had DOTS, you know, the direct observed shortcut treatment and all the principles that make DOTS, you know. So they also have a very good way of ensuring that people are taking their medicines correctly. So, you know, supplementing the two would be one way of, collaborating the two programs would be one of the ways to go. But also, if you find someone with TB, you do well to advise them to go and have an HIV test. And the other way around, people who are found to be HIV positive should be tested for TB. And in my view, it would be best if all those services were offered in one place rather than being tested for TB here and then being asked to walk for 2 miles to another center where they're doing the other test. I think that's the one way. But again, collaboration should be from the very highest level. For instance, the International Union Against Tuberculosis, the host of this conference, should be working really, really closely with UNAIDS, you know, especially in Africa. And if I had my own way, they should be in the same building. I know that they all developed differently, and it won't be very easy to sort of bring them together. But I mean, this is the way HIV and the TB germs work. You know, like it seems like the bugs are more intelligent than we are. They're collaborating very well. And with us, we continue saying this is a TB community and this is an HIV community. And look at me, for example. I had a co-infection, TB and HIV. It's one person, two diseases. So how can you have two groups trying to fight, you know, separately from each other? So it doesn't make really sense, you know. I must also mention that in Zambia, we've made strides in the last two governments. Very little was being done, you know. Now, okay, we have new leadership, very rapid scaling up of HIV treatment. But I think TB is still lagging behind. And so I think if more resources are put in from the government to do what they've done on the HIV side, that will be best.
In your estimation, is tuberculosis highly stigmatized?
This is probably something that many people won't believe it. When I was HIV, when I was told I'm HIV positive, and I told everybody I had, I said it in the media and so on, I faced very little stigma. I did face a little bit like people being funny about me and making. But when I had TB, when actually it showed, you know what I mean, yeah, that's when I really then experience stigma. Now, stigma is when you are discriminated directly, it's much better than being ignored, and that's exactly what the kind of stigma that I got when I had tuberculosis, where people just stopped coming to visit because they thought I was dying. You know what I mean? And but the thing is, there's a confusion. I don't know whether they were thinking I'm dying of TB or I'm dying of AIDS, because, you know, there's always that confusion. So it's difficult to really place the exact reason why there was more heightened stigma when I had tuberculosis than before I had any symptoms. But my feelings are that you're going to be more stigmatized when what is wrong with you can show. I think if you're HIV positive and you haven't told anybody and you're still healthy, you won't be stigmatized. You know, unless people learn about it, then there's, oh, he has it. You know what I mean? Yeah. But once you start losing your weight, which is one of the symptoms of tuberculosis, and you're coughing, and you can't come to work because you're too tired, and you have night sweats and so on, then there's no doubt there's something wrong with you. And because stigma is a mark. Remember, I mean, the definition of stigma, I think one of the dictionaries, it's like a mark of shame. And when you don't have that mark, it's difficult for people to stigmatize you. So in some way, TB is more stigmatizing than actually HIV when you don't have the symptoms. It's the same thing with Kaposi's, you know. Kaposi's, someone may have HIV, but if they don't have the spots, the Kaposi's spots, no one cares about them. Unless you shoot your mouth in the wrong place and people, so he has it. You know what I mean? But even when you don't say you have HIV, but you have Kaposi's sarcoma, very likely be stigmatized because it shows.
And last question for you. What do you tell or what advice would you give to countries outside of Africa where HIV is spreading and obviously tuberculosis will probably go with that as well? What lessons can other countries, say in Asia or other areas of the world, learn from what Africa has experienced in fighting both tuberculosis and HIV?
Well, I think countries in Asia where the co-infection is not as serious as in Africa. Back home, over 70% of people with TB when tested for HIV are also HIV positive. So there's a big reinfection. But in India, it's not so. You know, in India, there are a lot of TB cases that are just TB without HIV. But they'll catch up. I was talking to someone today from TB Alert who said we are seeing more and more people with TB who are also HIV positive. And you know, in India, where there's, I understand, I haven't been there, but I understand there's a lot of stigma around HIV. In other words, it will be underground for a long time. Then it will spread even more. I think there will be a bad explosion there, you know. And this is the problem of stigma, you know, that you just drive the epidemics underground. And with TB, if you drive it underground, people continue spreading it. It's the same thing, I think, with HIV. If you stigmatize people, then they don't want to be seen to go buying condoms because they think if they see me buying a condom, they'll say, why is he buying condoms? You know, and as a result, they just leave as if everything is fine and the disease is spreading. So, yeah. But for other developed countries like the G8 and so on, the message is simple. We live on one planet. This is our home. You know, we're just living in different bedrooms, basically, you know. But whatever happens in one part of the world is a concern of everybody. And I think it's even more true with diseases, infectious diseases. There was a time when people thought TB had been wiped out in the UK. It never was wiped out, you know. And now they're saying, I think very soon there'll be a report that show that about 8,000 cases of TB every year in the UK. And now we have extreme drug-resistant TB, you know. And so the message is simple. You know, you fight TB, you have to fight it everywhere.
Mr. Winston Zulu, HIV and TB activist, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. Thanks.